What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager. Robert, you and I both play pretty violent video games and enjoy them. But none of us are violent men, and I'm kind of curious about this. I mean, I spend a good 30 to 40 minutes a day just chilling out playing Titanfall and shooting a bunch of stuff, you know, and I find it relaxing. It's totally predicated on war and violence and, like, the mechanics of the game, like, have, like, there's, like, kill executions and stuff that are, you know, supposed to make it more thrilling or whatever. But, like, I get, like, a sort of zen quality of, like, clearing my mind from doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting to take it apart. I mean, it's true. I've never thrown or taken a punch in my life. I've never had, a true interest in personal martial arts, except, you know, maybe as just a possible way of, like, exploring your body awareness. I could see the appeal there. Yeah, violent media has always been present in my life. I write violent things from time to time. I've always been a fan of the simulated yet impactful theater violence of professional wrestling. And it does make me wonder to what extent is there, like, this innate violent aspect of humanity that finds its way out in these forms. I mean, I also ask these questions when I observe my 5-year-old son. I'm around him all the time. I don't know to what extent the influences of other children play into his demeanor, but I know that he digs mostly sweet things at his age. He likes animals. He likes Totoro. And yet he easily took to dinosaur violence. He likes to climb on me in a manner that feels kind of wrestling-esque. And he's taken to sort of punching me, but he doesn't call them punches. He pretends that his fists are dinosaur eradicating asteroids. And he'll go, "Asteroids falling." And then he sort of, like, pummels me with them,
I like,
but lightly.
That your kid is acting out, like, mass extinction level genocide with a punch. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, like the first time you watched Ponyo, another Miyazaki film, he was a little upset because Ponyo's dad was a little too serious.
Yeah.
And granted, he's voiced by Liam Neeson in the version he's watching, but he got upset over that. and had to grow to where he could watch Ponyo. But yet dinosaur eradication via extinction event, he's totally on board.
Yeah. Well, I imagine like he's seen skeletons in museums and stuff like that of dinosaurs. So he's got a firm grasp on that. Yeah. Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, not just your son and like the progression of violence, but just violence in general.
Mm-hmm.
It's been in the news lately, and I'm saying that now, and I suppose you could say that at any period of time, right? There's been violence in the news recently.
Yeah.
It just feels like it's omnipresent, and it's been kind of disturbing me. So a friend suggested that I read Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature for reassurance, because essentially the premise of this book is that the world is actually less violent than it used to be, and things are getting better in terms of violence, but slowly. It doesn't seem like it in the present because the media's attention is very much on the sort of like it bleeds, it leads news, right? So, of course, like there's constantly going to be stories about shootings or bombings or fires or knife attacks, right? And this kind of stuff is pretty disturbing and upsetting. And I think in a cynical worldview makes you think like, oh, gosh, like we are just, you know, bent on utter self-destruction. But Pinker's book actually makes a really good point that we're not, and that there are a lot of ways in which we're rising up out of that.
Now, you're probably asking, some of you may be asking yourself, who is Steven Pinker? Well, he's a Canadian-born American cognitive scientist, psychologist, linguist, and popular science writer. His name has come up a time or two on the podcast. I think, euphanisms, I think, were one of the recent things.
Okay.
We were discussing euphemisms in Pinker's writing.
He talks about euphemisms in here in relation to ideology. So we'll touch on that a little bit. And actually, this episode, this is like a meta Stuff to Blow Your Mind episode, because I feel like we're really zooming out big picture, looking at human biology, evolution, philosophy, and very specifically neuroscience in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
But it touches on many episodes that you and Joe and I have done in the past. So we'll be bringing in stuff from that as well.
Yeah, we're going to be zipping down the highway here. And along the way, there are going to be some exits that look very interesting. In some cases, those are avenues we've explored before. In other cases, they're avenues that we can explore in the future. So let us know, and we'll either direct you in the right direction or record a new episode that lines up with that area.
So just up front, I should establish that this book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, is massive. It's like 800, 900 pages long. So there's no way we could do an episode that would be of like normal length mm-hmm. for you to listen to where Robert and I discuss this entire book. It's just too big to do that. So for this episode, we're really honing in on a section that he refers to as inner demons. And this is where he explains why human beings are violent. And he does a really good job of doing it by doing this massive literature review of human existence and sort of how we've applied violence over time, but also what we've learned about violence through various research methods. We're going to touch on the other stuff that's in the book. And like Robert said, like if some of it comes up and you say like, oh, well, I would like a full episode on that, you know, we may gloss over it here, but talk to us and maybe we'll be able to do something in the future. So he starts off with doing this overall huge data analysis, basically. I think it's like the first six chapters of the book, where he essentially looks at the course of human history and says, yeah, violence is a major part of it, and it seems to be very specific to our species, but it doesn't have a fixed rate. So violence isn't like a human urge in the way that sex is or hunger or sleep. And he says, in fact, if you look at the data presented, violence has actually declined over time, and there's plenty of evidence that human beings are, in fact, averse to violence. So, for instance, this is something we've talked about on the show before. It comes up in The Office a little bit, too, that there's an example that most soldiers in war don't actually fire with the intent to kill during wartime.
This observation comes from the Second World War and from historian and U.S. Army Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall. And he reported the firing rate was 15-20%. And out of every 100 men engaged in a firefight, only 15 to 20 actually used their weapon. And then in Vietnam, for every enemy soldiers killed, more than 50,000 bullets were fired. But we have to point out that some critics have charged that Marshall's observations were more observational than a true scientific study. And others have been less kind.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, you can look at that and maybe like if you're worried about the amount of human violence that's going on in the world, you can say, well, that's an encouraging sign, right?
Right. And I should also point out that this is just one of the many examples that Pinker draws upon. And so he's not basing everything just on this thing about kill stats. And in general, when we're talking about Pinker's argument that violence is going down, he is talking about overarching statistical evidence and just in the broad picture of human culture. Obviously, an individual human is still capable of staggering cruelty and violence. We know the examples. We preserve the examples in our cultures like specimens on a shelf.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we have to come back to what does the larger picture say? What are the larger trends for humanity itself?
And so for evidence of human violence, Pinker actually at first turns to one of the an unlikely area that I would think of. But actually, when you brought up your son earlier, it makes sense. He looks at 2-year-olds as being the most violent stage of humanity, basically talking about, and you would know better than I do, but you know that like at that age, we're thrashing around a lot. We're more likely to get angry at the drop of a hat or burst into tears and really like, exert like, dominance and revenge kind of tactics over small petty things.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a difficult one to rule on because I just have the one child to base my observations on, and every kid's going to be a little different.
Maybe Pinker just had some really rough kids.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess that one of the things is when emotional responses are coming online for young children, there are less filters.
Yeah.
So when they feel mad over something, they feel it. And then when they feel happy about something, they just feel it. And so you observe these for an adult would be just crazy mood swings.
Yeah.
But for a child, like that's the palette they're painting with.
But even when you look at the statistics related to adults, it gets a little bit scary in terms of how much we fantasize about violence. 70 to 90% of men and 50 to 80% of women in a study, and these were all college students, admitted that they fantasized about killing someone. And this kind of gets into the sort of idea, like the general idea that bad people actually do what good people dream about doing, right? And this is why we have this violent fiction and fun, mm-hmm. right? Like our video games where we're shooting everything or we're watching horror movies or action movies or whatever.
I think the language here is very important. Like when we use terms like fantasize,
yeah.
that makes it sound like you're like, oh, the revenge fantasy on my head here is just, I'm really getting off on this vision of me punching that guy in the face.
Yeah.
Whereas, and we'll get into this more later on, but if you view it as a sort of mental simulation, if you're thinking of the things that I could do in response to this, this individual, ticking me off or offending me in some fashion,
yeah.
of all the possible things I can do, punching them is one of those things. And here is how it might play out in my mind. Here are the pros, here are the cons, here's how it might make me feel,
yeah.
But then here's how it might feel to get arrested. So if you look at it from that point of view, it's like it's not as creepy and weird as fantasizing about violence. It's more like, yeah, your brain knows that violence is always an option. It's just to what degree does your brain say that it's almost always never worth the effort?
Yeah, and Pinker later, you know, goes on to describe that as sort of one of our angels rather than our demons,
yeah.
is the ability to rationalize risk assessment, essentially, whether or not the risk and reward is worth it for violence. But where it gets real, and it's really worth us zooming in on, is the neuroscience, because neurosurgeons have described something that's referred to as the rage circuit in the mammalian brain. And I'm going to walk you through this using a rat's brain as an example to start off with.
Well, did you bring that in your pocket or
yeah,
on the cooler?
You know, well, I've got the rat and I figured I might as well take the brain out. So here we've got the rat brain. It has a pathway that connects 3 major structures in the lower parts of its brain. And these are similar to other mammalian brains like humans. A collar of tissue in there is called the para-aqueductal gray. And this is comprised of gray matter that is surrounded by a fluid-filled canal that runs from the spinal cord to the brain. And this is essentially where this rage circuit lies. It contains all the inputs that create our irritation, things like pain and hunger and blood pressure and our heart rate and temperature and our hearing. And so the para-aqueductal gray is partly under the control of our hypothalamus, and it's regulating emotional, motivational, and physiological states. It sits on the pituitary gland, which is pumping hormones into the bloodstream, regulating cortisol from our adrenal glands. And cortisol is pretty important here in terms of like the biochemistry. The hypothalamus itself, then, is regulated by the amygdala, which is applying our memory and our motivation, giving emotional coloring to our thoughts. So on top of all of this, this entire rage circuit is the cerebral cortex, and that patches into our eye sockets, literally, with the orbital cortex. These terms are going to be important later as we're going through sort of methods of rage turning into violence.
Now, I'm going to step away from Pinker for just a second to discuss some ideas by neurobiologist Douglas Fields. These are not ideas that are contrary to Pinker's arguments. I think they line up rather nicely, as we continue on with the discussion. But Fields has written a great deal about the rage circuit as well, and he argues that violent behavior is often the result of the clash between the modern world and the evolutionary hardwiring of our brains. We all have triggers, he says, and we have to be aware of them in order to manage them. And these are the triggers that he proposes. It spells out the word life morts.
I didn't know that was a real word.
Yeah, life morts. There's so many great band ideas already. Rage circuit, life morts.
Yeah, it's true.
Life morts is L-I-F-E-M-O-R-T-S. That L is for life and limb. That's defensive aggression as a trigger for your violence. Then I for insult. F for family or maternal aggression. So you're protecting your family, protecting your child, or at least that's the argument in your brain. Then there's environment territorialism. Then M for mate, which does not refer to British pub brawls, but rather mating behavior and mating aggression. Then there's O for organization, the organization you're a part of. R for resources or lack of resources. T for tribe. And S for stop, and this one refers to being trapped, constrained, or cornered.
Yeah, and as we'll discover with Pinker, that S part, the being trapped, restrained, or cornered, that's when humans can be their most violent.
Mm-hmm. Quick quote from Fields. This is from a National Geographic interview. He says, "You're not going to engage in violence and risk life and limb for a trivial reason. There are very specific triggers." So that's key here.
Yeah.
Even though our violence within the modern framework is irrational in many cases, it's tied into evolved responses that make sense in the long history of human evolution and sort of the full temporal picture of the human being.
Yeah. And Pinker makes this point, and I'm going to cap it at the end of our episode too, but that like the ability to define these things and recognize what's within ourselves that makes us capable of violence is sort of the first step towards stopping it from happening.
Indeed.
And so whether it's Fields' model or it's Pinker's model, you know, it just depends on what sort of like linguistic thing you're applying on top of it, but both help. Now, Pinker also focuses on practicality of violence, and he says, when you move toward harming a fellow human, it must accomplish two things. It's got to at least increase the chance that the target will come to harm, and it will give your target an overriding goal of harming you before you harm them. This means we have to consider the consequences of our actions practically, like we were talking about earlier, risk, mm-hmm. reward, rationality. This is why most human violence is cowardly, stealthy, and preemptive, right?
Yeah.
So we tend to do it from afar, or, you know, do it when somebody's not looking, or not be a part of it, right? It's very rare that, like, somebody will be so psychopathic that they will, like, murder hundreds of people face to face, because the human averseness to that violence is biological.
It brings to mind all these examples as generally from our fiction where like one character demands that the villain fight them fair and square.
Right.
And this is generally not what we do. We're all about, taking advantage and having the upper hand.
Oh yeah. And there's absolutely evolutionary reasons for that too. Another component of that Pinker brings up is something that he refers to as forward panic. And this is when humans face an opponent in a long state of apprehension and fear And then when they can catch that opponent in a moment of vulnerability, it leads to just utterly savage violence. This is human beings at their worst. So going back to that model that Fields has earlier, that's when you're trapped or restrained or cornered, right? And you've got the opportunity to break free from that. And that you just see human beings just go into just utter carnage then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is basically the whole idea of the Purge series, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I hadn't really thought of it before, but like those speak to sort of a real like inner quandary of human violence.
Yeah.
So he also argues, though, that the way that we get away with that in our own heads is because we have something called a moralization gap. And this is where we create narratives of victims and perpetrators, and they diverge, and only really a neutral party can see how they diverge from one another. So it's really kind of self-serving thinking that's a form of cognitive dissonance. And we develop all kinds of mental strategies of self-deception to help support it. Subsequently, this quirk in psychology means no one thinks they're evil, right? Like you hear, think about that in the world, like people who are described as villains, no one sits around and thinks, I'm evil, I'm doing evil, right? They all think that what they're doing is innocent and that they themselves are long-suffering victims within their own narratives. So they always think they're acting morally. And Pinker reminds us here of Hannah Arendt's infamous term, the banality of evil, when referring to the ordinariness of the Nazis' atrocities during World War II. It's worth remembering this when you're looking at our storytelling too, right? Like whether you're making a story, you're watching a movie or reading a book, even the worst bad guy has justifications for why they think what they're doing is right, you know? And so when we tend to watch fiction, it's just like, this guy's just evil for the sake of being evil. At least in this current day and age, that's not necessarily engaging for us, right?
Right, yeah. You need some idea of their motivations and why they view their actions as righteous.
Yeah.
And again, this all makes perfect sense if you look at things from a life mort's standpoint. The triggers are there. They're evolved to enable survival. And what you can think of is the temporally average human, the tribal hunter-gatherer, the hominid. All of this culture business is relatively new.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. A couple other terms I want to establish up front for Pinker before we get into what his quote-unquote demons are. Another thing that he describes within the brain is the seeking system, and this runs from the forebrain through a bundle of fibers in the middle of the brain to the ventral striatum, which we call the reptilian brain. It was discovered in rats when psychologists realized that if they stimulated it with an electrode via a lever, the rats themselves, they would hit this lever. It would stimulate the electrode in their own brain. And what they would start doing is hitting the lever over and over and over again, stimulating that part of their brain until they became utterly exhausted. And these connections are actually two-way. They're not top-down. So mm-hmm. all these components in the brain, they're talking to each other. The neurons within are signaling each other with the neurotransmitter dopamine. And this motivates animals to achieve goals. For instance, hunting. There's actually also a fear circuit that is theorized, and it's connected to the rage circuit. And some extreme fear, so this goes back to what we were talking about being, you know, caught or trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme fear will trigger an enraged defensive attack or violence. So there you go. Likewise, there may be another motivational system that triggers violence that is referred to here as intermale aggression or the dominant system. Basically, the idea here is that the seeking system in our brain leads males of a species to willingly seek out aggressive challenges with other males. And this sometimes also leads to blind rage. Now, the difference here between the rat brain that I've got here in my hand and our human brains is that these structures are enveloped by large bloated cerebrum. For humans, we have this big cerebrum surrounding all of this stuff, and it's taken up by the frontal lobes, which possibly contends with our rage and fear with things like restraint, prudence, and morality. And this is where Phineas Gage comes up. Good old Phineas Gage. I can't imagine how many episodes, if you go back through the Stuff to Blow Your Mind catalog, he comes up as an example.
Yeah, Phineas Gage. He comes up quite a bit. This was a 19th century individual. There was a freak railway accident that blasted a crowbar-like tool called a tamping iron up through his skull. It entered under the left cheekbone and exited through the top of his head. And it basically gave him a frontal lobotomy.
So when I was in high school, for Dare, they made t-shirts for all of us that had Phineas Gage's skull with the railway rod shooting through it.
Dare? You mean to keep a kid off drugs? That
yes, yeah. Because it was a demonstration of what your head was like when you were drunk or when you were on certain kinds of drugs. So it was supposed to be these t-shirts that would remind you, like, if you drink and you drive, you're just going to be like a guy with a rod through his head. They were like, I thought it was kind of cool at the time, but like, I look back on it, it's like this really morbid example to give kids.
Yeah. Like that's not what it's like, kids. It also makes me imagine like a local evening news story. Kids call it gauging. They're blasting tamping irons up through their skull in order to get high.
Well, if they were doing that, they would have to make sure that they actually destroyed the orbital cortex and the ventromedial cortex, because that was what is theorized to be destroyed in Phineas Gage's brain, which led to these unchecked emotions he was experiencing. So the orbital cortex is actually adjacent to something called the insula, and that registers our physical gut feelings. This is when you say something like, you've got a physical trigger, like my blood is boiling when you're angry. This is coming from the insula. But when you scan the brains of people who are prone to violence, especially those with antisocial personality disorder, the orbital regions, those are shrunken and less active. But when you compare this to somebody like an impulsive murderer, you find that their orbital cortex is actually malfunctioning. So it's not smaller, it's just not working the way it's supposed to be. And so it seems that this is our major inhibitor of violence, the orbital cortex. And certain acts of violence are weighed as being justifiable by our brains. So for instance, let me give you a scenario, Robert. What if there were five people on a train platform and you could see that they were going to be run over by the train? The only way you could stop the train was to push another person in front of the train and derail it.
Oh, well, this is a classic moral problem, right?
Right.
Well, you have to choose whatever benefits the most people, right?
Yeah, it's very Spock, right?
Yeah.
The needs of
but
the many.
But at the same time,
the
I refuse to murder anybody.
Exactly. Yeah. So you get into this quandary between the logic of it and the humanity of it, right? And we react against this with our amygdala and our orbital cortex. And you have like a more utilitarian mode of thinking, like let's call it the Spock mode of thinking. That's your dorsolateral cortex, where our intellectual abstract problem solving is done. All right, we got all that out of the way. We've covered the brain pretty thoroughly. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we're going to get into the actual demons that Pinker has defined here, the five things that make us violent.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. on demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
All right, we're back. It's time to summon the five demons.
Yeah. Get out your pentagrams and your salt. No, oh, they're not those kind of demons.
Yeah, they're not the fun kind. But I guess we can imagine what their forms might look like.
Yeah, it works very well within Pinker's format for this book, because, you know, the title, The Better Angels of Our Nature, the idea is that after he presents these demons that we're going to talk about in this episode, then he presents the angels subsequently that we use to combat these demons that would keep us from being as violent as we could be.
Yes. So the five demons argument, this is a rejection of the hydraulic theory of violence. And the hydraulic theory is basically what I was bringing up earlier when I was saying, oh, do I play violent video games because there's a inherent violence in my body and this is the necessary escape valve?
Yeah.
Yeah, the hydraulic theory is simply that humans have an inner drive to violence, a bloodlust that has to be satisfied one way or the other. And this is a rejection of that argument.
Yeah, that's Pinker's main thing, is that we are not, there's no actual single psychological route that makes us violent. In fact, he says there's five things. There are predation, dominance, revenge, sadism, and ideology. And we're going to go through each of these and kind of touch upon Pinker's, you know, definitions for why these are the things that make us violent.
Ooh, I'm envisioning this pack of demons right now with their grotesque bodies in there.
That'd be a fun project for Stuff to Blow Your Mind fans if you wanted to draw our five demons of violence for Pinker's setup there.
I like it.
So predation, I'm imagining that's going to look something like a predator, of course. It's going to have like the dreadlocks and the weird spider mouth.
Yeah, the mandibles.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay. Well, what Pinker means by this is that it's a use of force as a means to an end, and it's usually deployed in pursuit of a goal that's set up by that seeking system part of the brain that we mentioned earlier. So, for instance, when you're hunting for food or sport, that's literal predation, right? You're preying upon another species. There's a certain amount of empathy that we have with prey as well in many cultures, right? Like, a lot of cultures revere the animals that they kill for their food.
Yeah, look no further than the ancient horned gods of chaos, unpredictability of the hunt. And you can look, too, to the deer stickers you see on the back of trucks that clearly belong to deer hunters, the trophies they put in their homes. And perhaps, this is kind of a stretch, but maybe even the weird anthropomorphized mascots of barbecue restaurants.
Yes.
You know, like the talking pigs and pots.
You brought this up a couple days ago in one of our company meetings, and you were 100% right. Every time I drive past a barbecue place, I am confounded. The logos are either pigs that look like they're like so excited to be about to be eaten, or like they're about to eat themselves.
Yeah, they're like eating ribs from their own body.
Yeah, like they've got knives and forks pointed at their bellies and they're grinning. It's the strangest thing. But you're right. It's kind of like our modern version of honoring the food that we're eating.
Yeah.
But Pinker argues when you've got this chasm between the perpetrator's perspective and the victim, so you don't have that kind of honoring, it makes it a lot easier to conduct predatory violence. And so this is when atrocities are committed and we say, how could they possibly do that, right? Our empathy is actually outweighing the predatory perspective. And this is why it helps for perpetrators themselves to be able to see their victims as quote unquote vermin or morally disgusting, right? We talked about the moralization gap before. That's where it comes into play. They basically convince themselves, well, these people are less than me and they're deserving of this.
Yeah, it's the act of othering that we still see in many cases today. Really we see it all over the place. Like to whatever extent you can make the other party less human,
yep,
and more of an alien entity, then more becomes permissible towards them.
Tying back into Pinker, demonization.
Mm-hmm.
So turning them into demons. Now, he also talks about positive illusions as being this sense where we think, oh, well, we're lucky or we're super capable or we can justify ways that make it easier for us to be predatory, right? We usually exaggerate ourselves as a useful tool when we're facing a rival. And, the reason why is like if the world didn't have these positive illusions, there might only be violence when two rivals were closely matched. Because mm-hmm. Let's face it, they're not always matched equally. So an example of this works when you look at war, right? So perfect example, Napoleon and Hitler both trying to invade Russia. Like those were obviously difficult odds, but they were countries that initiated wars and ended up losing them. And here's what's interesting. When you look at the statistics, countries that initiate wars, they lose them 25 to 50% of the time. So people and nation states get into fights that they can't win all the time.
Huh, and this is based on their bravado, buying into their own hype.
Exactly, yeah. Now, leaders can totally overestimate that bravado, and that's what leads us into this. Pinker also calls this the Lake Wobegon effect after a Prairie Home Companion and Garrison Keillor, because the idea here is that everyone assumes that they're better than average. So when you ask the general populace and you say, are you average? Are you lower than average? Are you better than average? Everybody says they're better than average.
Yeah, especially in America, that's the idea of American exceptionalism, right?
Exactly.
Everybody has the potential for greatness. Nobody is locked into a particular caste.
So this leads us to the second demon on our shoulder, which is dominance. And this is essentially our drive for supremacy over our rivals. And it's tied back into that brain part that Pinker was talking about earlier, which is the inter-male aggression. Here's the thing, though. It's easy to hear that and think, oh, well, men are only violent. But actually, it's not gender exclusive. It's just that men tend to exhibit these qualities for biological reasons we'll get into.
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea is that for when you look at the broad history of the human species, you have a situation where the males have the body for violence, and then in turn, they have more of a brain for the violence. They're more wired for the physical violence.
Right, right. So if you look at homicides, the largest motive for them in all altercations is trivial in origin. It's usually things like somebody insulted me or they accidentally jostled me. But the participants, they actually behave as if there's more at stake, which leads to murder. And this kind of violence, it acts as a way to prove dominance so that you, as sort of like an alpha, are challenged less, right? The goal here is actually a spreading of information by showing that you're the stronger one. Hopefully the crowd will see this and they'll spread it along so that you're challenged less often. Studies actually of American street violence show that young men who have a code of honor are more likely to perpetrate violence because that code of honor sort of helps them with the moralization gap. Likewise, if there's an audience presence, that doubles their likelihood that they're going to be violent because that audience will help spread that information. Now, this calls back to the episode that Joe and I did where we interviewed Franz de Waal, where we talked about primates and how primates will fight with one another, but then after, they'll reconcile. And DeWall's theory was that this is because their long-term interests are bound together. So primates actually do their own version of rationalization.
And with bonobos, the reconciliation often takes a sexual form.
Yeah, yeah, that came up as well, I believe. Now, that's a good point to bring into the gender difference here, which is that, okay, men, yes, are far more violent, and they are more likely to value their professional status and to take greater risks due to overconfidence. This is actually thought to be a product of evolution, as males can reproduce more quickly than females, so they're competing for sexual opportunities. In the male brain, there's a nucleus in the anterior preoptic portion of the hypothalamus that is twice the size of a female's, and there are so many receptors in the system that are for testosterone, which is actually 5 to 10 times more plentiful in men. That makes sense to us, but the fact that the receptors are for that leads you to understand why men can be more violent. Now, biologists aren't actually convinced that testosterone is fully to blame for male aggression. Instead, they think that what it does is it prepares men for the challenge of dominance, getting back to this demon, the secondary demon here of dominance. It's getting us ready for that challenge.
Now, Fields, he pretty much backs all of this up. And he also points out, though, that this is all a double-edged sword, because certainly 90% of inmates are male, but 90% of Carnegie Institute medals for heroism have gone to men as well. Now, there you can tease that apart in
sure.
various ways. But he said, again, you can attribute much of this to evolution of male and female brains. That's how we evolve. Men have the body, greater strength, size for violence, and then therefore they have the brains to use it.
So Pinker actually argues that this is a bad scenario when you've convinced yourself of your sort of grandiosity, right, your bravado. If you have too much self-esteem, you're more prone to violence. So people who are narcissistic and think well of themselves but out of proportion with their actual achievements, those are the people you should be worried about in terms of dominance and violence. This is a trio of symptoms that Pinker says can actually make for a political leader that is a tyrant. And he says these are grandiosity, the need for admiration, and a lack of empathy. But through our identities as members of social groups, we actually see our dominance play out in less violent ways. And this is one of the ways that we sort of defeat this, right? We've got sports teams or political parties, for instance. And this can also lead to attitudes such as racism and other discriminations, right? The idea of pitting social groups in one way or another against each other. People, to varying degrees, harbor ultimately a motive for social dominance. And the idea here is that the group that they belong to is part of a hierarchy, and they want their group to always be on top in that hierarchy. So Pinker's arguing that maybe social dominance itself, it might not be about race per se, but more about what he calls coalition, where groups have evolved together and they band together. And he brings it back to that part of the brain again, intermale aggression. And he provides evidence that racism is actually more likely to target minority men than minority women. So he provides some studies in this book showing that that is actually the case. So racism's more likely to take place between men of different races than between a man and a woman of different races. Now, this becomes especially deadly when you combine it with nationalism. So that's basically a welding of tribalism. It's a cognitive conception of the group that you belong to, and it's the political apparatus of the government that we belong to, right? You combine all these things together, and this can lead to the conviction that one's nation has the right to greatness, that it deserves to be great, it deserves to be on top of the hierarchy. Any lowering of that status is explained away as malevolence, and it's applied to either an internal or an external foe. Now, Pinker, he comes out with sort of like a positive take on this, and he hopes that dominance will actually be tempered by the civilized institutional systems that we exist within. So he actually says the governmental part, hopefully that and laws and et cetera, will keep us sort of on track and keep us from being violent. He says inroads for women together with cosmopolitanism will help as well, and having a scientific understanding of these biological processes will hopefully make us more self-aware about where our violent urges for dominance are coming from.
So to a certain degree, it's the idea that that hopefully the thing that we will want dominant and the thing that we will push all this longing for dominance into will be more positive international models or species wide models for what we can be.
Yeah.
As a people.
I think that's where he's going with it. And in the latter sections, which we'll touch on at the end of the episode, but the sort of angel sections, both feminization and cosmopolitanism are listed as being factors there. So let's cross our fingers and hope that's the case. And he definitely provides evidence throughout the book where, you know, this episode isn't about that. We can't cover everything, but the steep drop in violence over the course of history is definitely on display in this book. It takes him a good six chapters to show it, but there's a lot there.
All right, let's summon the revenge demon, the demon that's all about driving us to pay back harm in kind, fired up by the rage circuit.
Right, so this is the third demon. It is the urge for vengeance, and it's actually a major cause of violence. And what's kind of weird is we seem to celebrate it in our cultures, right? Like, everybody loves a good revenge story. Like,
oh, yeah.
I haven't seen John Wick yet, but everybody talks about that movie as being like, oh, it's the ultimate revenge film, man. It feels good, you know?
I don't know if it's the ultimate revenge picture, but it's fun. And of the revenge trope, the basic revenge pacing is something we can all easily hop on board with.
Yeah, that's a narrative that we're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And as such, it's actually the motivation for 10 to 20% of the homicides that occur in the entire world. When you take this to a macro scale, revenge is essentially the motive for things like terrorism, when nations retaliate against it, and then subsequent wars we engage in, right? So let's look at the neurobiology here. Get back to that rage circuit that we described before. Let's say an animal is hurt or frustrated, and it wants to lash out at its nearest likely perpetrator. This is fed information from the temporoparietal junction, and that indicates whether the harm was intentional or accidental. Then the rage circuit activates, and it turns on the insular cortex, which gives us sensations of pain, disgust, and anger. And studies have also found that feelings of revenge actually light up the region of the brain that is associated with craving sweets, nicotine, or cocaine. So when they weigh the pleasure of revenge over the pain it might cause, it actually lights up the orbital and ventromedial frontal cortex, which we talked about earlier. So those frontal areas seem to really be what's keeping us from just going into blind, like Wolverine Hulk rage all the time. And that is interesting, the idea of associating it with sweets, right? Because we'd speak of, in poetic language, like the sweetness of a revenge. Revenge is a dish best served cold. Like stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have a lot of other sayings about revenge too, right? That there's the old Chinese proverb that if you set out on a course of revenge, be prepared to dig two graves.
Exactly, yeah. Which is thinking more with the front part of your brain, yeah, than the rage circuit. So this all leads to the function of risk assessment and deterrence, which, you know, is what Robert's talking about with that proverb, to convince your rivals that they have any attempt to advance their interests at your expense will lead to such severe penalties that their gambit will end with a net loss. So this is essentially like applying capitalism to revenge theory here, right? Like it turns it into sort of a net gain kind of situation, a risk reward situation. But that really is how our brains weigh the factors involved.
Yeah, I mean, when you start looking at nuclear deterrence, like that's basically the whole argument there. It basically, like any nation's nuclear deterrent exists to ensure that any nuclear attacker will have to dig two graves.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And this brings up something that I think has come up on the show before, but I'm not sure. It's called the prisoner's dilemma game. And we don't have time to go into the whole scenario here. Honestly, that would be a whole episode. But the result is essentially that people are more likely to selfishly defect from one another and get a greater punishment than they are for cooperating altruistically and getting a smaller punishment. So this is a game of studies that has been run on multiple people, and every time it comes out the same. Theoretical models take that even further, and they find out that over time, in iterations, researchers can theorize that the long-term effects of revenge on humanity are pretty complicated. And that might be fun for us to explore in another episode. But essentially, most people employ what are referred to as tit-for-tat strategies and enjoy cooperation over the threat of revenge. So that seems like a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Now, this made me think immediately, what's the most popular superhero team in the world right now?
Suicide Squad.
Oh, you're right. That's even worse. The Avengers, right? And Avengers insinuates that their motive, their goal is all about revenge, right? And that revenge primarily works as a deterrent if the Avenger has a reputation for being able to carry it out, right? So subsequently, this is why most, not Avengers like the superheroes, but just Avengers who are enacting revenge, they want the target to know that they met out the punishment, right?
Well, I have a serious comics question then. How much avenging do the Avengers actually get up to? And is there like a ruling council that decides if the matter is vengeance worthy?
I don't think so. I think that's just a cool name that they plucked out of the air. But remember in the Joss Whedon movie, I think he felt like he had to justify the name.
That's right.
And so it was like when one of their friends were killed, that was when they were like, okay, now we're going to have our revenge. We're the Avengers. We have to avenge somebody.
But for the most part, we don't have an entire heroic organization based around this often vilified, but sometimes celebrated concept.
No, but you know, that would be a really interesting take on doing the Avengers. I think that Marvel should hire you and get right on that. I like the idea of having like, there's a council that's like the Hulk and Captain America and Iron Man and Black Widow sitting around, and they're like, well, I don't know. Does it really justify revenge? Now, revenge evolved to be a deterrent. So then we have to ask ourselves, why is it so common in the world if the idea is it's supposed to deter other violence? Pinker again points to that moralization gap because people consider the harms that they're inflicting to actually be justified. And subsequently, law and government come into play as implements to keep our revenge in check. So maybe the Avengers need that. And hopefully we internalize this even when the rule of law isn't around to monitor us all the time. And real quick, he says other ways of curtailing revenge include broadening your circle of empathy from those who you're close to outward. So most of us are automatically empathetic with our family and our friends, but try being empathetic with people further out from you. Or when your relationships are too valuable to sever. Also, he says a sincere apology can go a long way. Politically, we've actually seen a huge spike in apologies and reconciliations since the 1980s. It's really interesting when you look at the graph of this. Like, nations or like big religious organizations didn't used to apologize to each other. It's a relatively new thing, and it's essentially to try to keep the whole revenge factor from getting out of control.
All right. Well, the demons of sadism and ideology are standing outside, their metals clinking, their chains and whips dangling. But we're going to take a quick break before we let them into our hearts.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah. Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billings, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during and after your stay so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back.
What's that knocking on the door?
Oh, well, that's sadism demon.
I hear it, and it is full of a joy for hurting. Now, here's the thing about sadism. It is inherent to human beings, but it might just be a psychological quirk. So let's go through this, and hopefully we'll find out that we're not all inherently sadistic.
Yeah, and this is definitely one of those areas where this could be a topic unto itself, but we're going to... We're going to run through it as best we can.
Yeah. So to many of us, sadism is not just morally monstrous, but we're also baffled by it, right? Because there's no apparent benefit from sadism. Now, think about torture, for instance. Some people like to justify torture as being a method of sadism that's worthwhile. For instance, if you have a ticking bomb scenario, right? A bomb's about to go off. The only way you can find out is if you torture the suspect and they tell you where the bomb is. But we actually find that it's seldom instrumental because victims will really say anything to just make the torture stop.
Yeah.
Now, you look at our past entertainment, right? It's full of sadistic acts. We've got the Roman Colosseum and other blood sports. And then you look at the history of serial killers. Now, here's where I'm not 100% on board with Pinker. He aligns serial killers in general with sexual gratification. And given what I know from researching the topic of serial killers for things here at work, that's not always the case, but maybe that's something we should go into in a different episode. Serial killers, though, they're not exactly new, right? They seem like they're a product of modern society, but it's been around for a long time. It's just taken other forms.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those cases, too, where it's become harder to be really good at it.
Right.
Given advances in society, and likewise, I guess the ones who are really good at it are so good at it, you never know they're serial killers.
That's the scariest part, yeah. So Pinker's argument about sadism is that, and you can check yourself on this and maybe you'll discover something about yourself and your sadistic or non-sadistic qualities, is that it requires two things. The first thing is a motive to enjoy others' suffering. And the second is the removal of restraints that allow people to act upon the motives to enjoy other people's suffering. So he boils this down to a couple different things. First of all, the macabre. That's when we have this morbid fascination with the vulnerability of living things. His example here is when you're a little kid and you pull the legs off bugs, right? Or you're driving by a car accident and you slow down so you can try to get a look at it.
That leaves a lot of room for interpretation. There are versions of that where you can say someone's a morbid artist, but they're not necessarily hurting bugs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Even the whole slowing down for car wrecks. Anybody that's ever done any amount of driving on the interstates, that people seem to be engaging in this to a considerable degree, enough to, shut down traffic in the lane that is not directly affected by
right.
the wreck. So, yeah, I think there's a big tent there on that first category.
Yeah, I'll throw this in just as like a qualifier about this book, which I really like this book, but there are points where Pinker supplies a lot of evidence. He cites sources, and then there's points where he just kind of throws things out, mm-hmm. where he's like, here's my take on the world, and I think this was one of them. Now, he also pulls in two of the demons that we previously discussed as being part of sadism, dominance and revenge. Now, in the case of dominance, it's sort of a schadenfreude, right? Like, we like the idea of somebody we want to dominate falling down on a banana peel, right?
Yeah.
Like, it fills us with glee. And likewise, with revenge, there's this idea of justice, right?
Yeah, so vengeance is served and justice is served.
Exactly, well. Yeah. You did a really good imitation of Ghost Rider there. That's what I...
is that his catchphrase?
I think it's something along those lines, yeah. He's the spirit of vengeance. Now, Pinker, again, I think sexuality isn't exactly Pinker's strong suit, but he gets into sexual sadism here, too, and he argues that the circuits for sexuality and aggression are intertwined within the limbic system, and both of these respond to testosterone. So examples, for instance, include veterans who describe killing in war, and they say, like, it's an actual sexual release for them. Or the other example he gives is reports from SS concentration camps where commanders reportedly masturbated during floggings of prisoners. So he's making this argument that there's an inherent connection between sexuality and aggression. He does it very briefly. I'm not 100% convinced, along the lines of also that, like, all serial killers are doing it for sexual reasons.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of room for questioning and elaboration there. I mean, for instance, you can take into account the fact that many people's different kinks and fetishes involve essentially violent themes.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily violent people. I feel like Pinker is maybe going a little just surface level on this.
Yeah, and there are points where he sort of like brushes up against sadomasochism and bondage,
mm-hmm.
but it, like, I got the impression that it wasn't a topic he was like intimately familiar with, you know?
I'm imagining Pinker at like a dungeon,
right.
literally brushing up against people in a bondage scene, and it's hilarious.
But. So he actually says, all right, we've got all these possible sources for sadism. Why, then, is it less common than all of these other forms of violence that we end up with? Well, his reasons are empathy. So, for instance, like, when he talks about empathy, he's not just talking about feeling each other's pain or inhabiting their minds, but he's actually thinking about aligning your happiness with that of another being. And he says this is more like sympathy or compassion.
Yeah, and as we've explored in past discussions about psychopaths in particular, there's this argument that with most of us, the empathy switch is default on.
Yeah.
And with these individuals, it's default off, but can be turned on, can be employed mm-hmm. through the right, sort of training and mental exercises. In the same way that we can and do find ways to tamper our empathy through, you know, othering and the reducing of another person to something less than human.
Right. So this is a perfect example of why it's important to be able to identify scientifically, like, what causes these things, so that we can then say, all right, we know what this is. We know the symptoms. Let's look where we think it is in the brain. And then you have to ask yourself, is it morally right to turn that switch back on?
Well, to bring it, we're talking about demons. And I know anything from the Dungeons and Dragons Monster Manual, it's that knowing the true name of a demon gives you power over it.
You know? I think you just nailed the episode title. another thing he says that curtails this is cultural taboo, right? So mostly the world and its governments see torture as being immoral. That's mm-hmm. why it's prohibited by the 1949 Geneva Conventions and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Humans also have a visceral revulsion, and that inhibits us from hurting other people, right? So just the sight or sound of seeing someone screaming in pain, it's enough to make primates averse to eating food. And this is a perfect point to bring up Stanley Milgram's experiment for evidence that participants were visibly distraught when they thought that they were electrocuting people they couldn't see, right?
You know, this brings up something. So the primates in this study had trouble eating during this.
Yeah.
And yet, I was in the theater with you at Alien Covenant, and I think people were eating popcorn the entire time.
Oh, man, I was,
like,
yeah.
In some of the more grisly scenes, like people's jaws being sliced off. And,
yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, how are you just still taking in palmful after palmful of that delicious popcorn?
There is, you know, for me, there are certain horror movies that I can't eat during.
Mm-hmm.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre is one of those.
Yeah.
That movie does something, like, somehow it taps into that visceral revulsion And I don't know how it does it differently than Alien Covenant. But during Alien Covenant, I just felt like everything was obviously fake.
Yeah. Huh.
But there are horror movies that certainly do that for me.
Well, I will say it's Alien Covenant was certainly very polished. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre has that feel to it that you're almost watching documentary footage.
Yeah.
That it could be real. And yet I'm sure there are people out there who have like a regular ritual of eating barbecue during TCM. So I have no idea.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. They probably do that at the Alamo Draft House.
That
once
sounds
a
like
year.
Something Alamo would do. Yeah.
And you were talking about psychopaths earlier. So they've got this disabled inhibition against sadism. That's because their amygdala and their orbital cortex shows a blunted response to signs of distress. So if they see a person screaming, they're less likely to respond to it. Pinker actually argues that besides psychopaths, sadism actually has to be cultivated over time. And his examples include, for instance, when you have older prison guards who participate in torture because it's something they've gotten used to over time, serial killers again, and then middle-aged crowds, not people who are of middle age, but crowds in the Middle Ages, that they acclimatize to public sadism as a part of everyday life, right? Like torturing people in public or these coliseums where you'd feed people the lions or whatever.
Right, right. So in a way, it ceases to be a taboo.
Right.
And then also this makes me wonder about the cycle of violence as well.
You know,
an individual being more likely to participate in the violence because some level of this was perpetrated upon them, that might be a valid argument as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you look at this, at least the sadism, and it says something about us that's both terrifying but also a little hopeful for the reduction of violence in human society, which is, you know, thankfully, we have this natural inhibition that's built into most of us, and thankfully, it takes most of us a long time to build up a tolerance to become sadistic. So, this leads us to our final demon.
Yeah, I see him right here, the ideology demon.
This is when believers weave a collection of motives into a creed and then recruit others to carry out its destructive goals. And man, this could be a podcast in two of itself, so we're going to really boil this down quickly. Pinker's argument here is there's an important distinction because the body counts of history get way higher when large numbers of people actually work together toward violence. Now, what's dangerous about ideology is essentially it promises utopia, which prevents its believers from weighing that cost-benefit analysis that we were talking about in the front of the brain. Likewise, it paints its opponents as inherently evil and deserving of punishment. So again, it gets around that moralization.
Yeah, this is the classic holy war scenario.
Totally. Pinker again turns to Milgram's experiment as evidence of what we're willing to do if it's part of our social understanding. So it's worth remembering that 65% of the participants in that study were willing to go all the way up to the maximum shock level.
Yeah, just because they were being told to do it.
Mm-hmm. And further evidence from research by John Darley and Bib Latane's study on bystander apathy shows that people that might respond to an emergency as a single person will fail to respond to that emergency if they're in a group of people. Because if they're in a group, they assume, well, if nobody else is doing anything, the situation can't be that bad.
Yeah, there's an older episode that I did with Julie where we get into this at length. And it's interesting to have that information and then go in and do a CPR training course.
Yeah.
Because they directly play upon that. The whole idea that they're training you to be the person that actually steps forward and starts initiating CPR.
Yeah.
But then also, you don't just say, somebody call 911. You point to someone and you say, you call 911.
Right. You have to be active and not passive.
Right. And you have to be specific. Because if you just say, someone do it, then the bystander effect's going to take place. And people are like, oh, I guess somebody's going to call 911. And everyone just stands around hesitating while time ticks by.
And this sounds horrible, right? But at the same time, like, it's worth recognizing, like, this is part of human nature. If we're aware of it, then we can do things like apply it in CPR courses so that we can save lives. Now, this leads to another famous experiment that, of course, is going to come up in this episode, the Stanford Prison Experiment. This is where participants were given faux roles as prisoners and guards. The guards quickly took their roles way too far, and they abused their power. The experiment had to be called off after 6 days for the safety of the people playing the role of prisoners. And this demonstrates that when a group of people is given power over another group, it can actually bring out barbaric behavior in people who would otherwise never display it. So Pinker wonders, have we actually progressed enough since these studies, since Milgram, since the Stanford Prison Experiment, that participants would be more likely to disobey orders or to take advantage of authority in these situations? So he's essentially saying, if we conducted those experiments today, would modern day, inhibitions, culture, politics, etc., keep those results from being as high as they were the first time around?
Huh.
Now, some people have replicated that, and you can look at those studies separately. They're also in the book. He takes a look at something called the spirals of silence, and he says this is the phenomenon of people just going along with the crowd. And even on violence, simply because they think, look, it's going to make other people in the crowd happy. So when you survey a group of people afterwards, after a violent act, the majority of them will say, oh, yeah, I realized at the time that it was unpleasant or what we were doing was wrong, but I wanted to make sure everybody else around me thought I was with them. So there's all kinds of methods in ideology that keep violence perpetuated. We talked earlier about the moralization gap, euphemisms. You brought up euphemisms earlier as being a Pinker thing. So he says euphemisms are one single way that our language and communication allows us to get away with being violent. Think of the difference between the terms collateral damage, ethnic cleansing, and just murder. Right. Yeah. So the sort of vagueness of those former terms makes it seem a little bit more acceptable. He says there's all kinds of other ways that we sort of, methodize our ideology in violence. He talks about gradualism, responsibility, how distant we are literally from the violence as it's happening. In fact, this is one of my favorite quotes. He says, it's safe to say that the pilot of the Enola Gay who dropped the atomic bomb over Hiroshima would not have agreed to immolate 100,000 people with a flamethrower one at a time.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting take on the ideology aspect of violence. He talks more about demonization and dehumanizing victims and minimizing the harm that you're doing, relativizing the harm that you're doing, and falling back upon requirements of your task. So, for instance, when people make the argument, oh, well, it was just my job or I was only following orders. So this leads us to the angels. Pinker says he thinks the vaccine here specifically for ideology is to have an open society where people and ideas are allowed to move about freely and no one is punished for having dissenting views. That sounds kind of like what we're in right now, right? Which might be why he argues that violence has declined massively over time. Now, what other solutions does he present us with? Well, like I said, the mere step of identifying these demons is supposed to be a step in the right direction, but it's followed by the four angels. And we're not going to dive as deeply into those angels, but let's talk about them briefly.
Yeah, the demons are always more interesting.
That's true.
But yeah, you've identified the demons, you've learned their true names, given you the power over them, and now you have to summon some angels to really, whack them. So the first one is empathy, and we've recorded whole episodes on this one before. It's pretty vital. This is the ability to feel the pain of others and or attempt to understand that pain, and it gives us the power to align our interests with the other person. And a lot of this comes down to our mirror neurons and theory of mind. It's a vital tool for navigating a world full of unknowable minds. We have to be able to put ourselves in their vicious heads in order to dodge and maneuver in this bone-slinging world of tribal horror. But, of course, that enables modern individuals especially much more than mere Stone Age Machiavellianism, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not just I have to know my adversary. It also means you can know your friends. It means you have a better idea of what's going in the head of even the average person on the street. Some stranger that you'll never know, that you'll never even exchange a word with, but thanks to theory of mind, you can contemplate what their position in their worldview consists of,
and then you can take it that step further and turn empathy into sympathy or compassion,
right,
where you're actually tying your happiness into their happiness.
Yeah, that's the final form of this angel, I think.
Yeah.
It's Pokemon evolution.
Yeah.
All right, the next angel is self-control. So, yeah, willpower.
And this ties into another key cognitive ability, which is known as chronesthesia or mental time travel. So it kind of comes back to what we were talking about with revenge earlier.
Yeah.
We can weigh the outcomes of our intended or considered acts. And as such, Pinker's point is that we can anticipate the outcome of acting out on our impulses and inhibit them as needed. So if the cost is too high, the risk is too great, then we can just tamp it down. And this, like empathy, becomes even grander in the human condition. Because in many cases, we can live entire lives, maybe not too happy lives of lives, but we can live entire lives inhibiting perfectly natural impulses.
Right.
So, you know, there's solace to be taken in that fact.
Right, yeah. And this gets back to, I mean, he mentioned a lot of these angels along the way and the demons, which is that the self-control part really is wired to the front part of our brains.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that we can take a little bit of solace in, which is that, like, we're actually wired up to out-rationalize the rage portion.
Yeah. Now, the next one, the third angel, is moral sense. So this governs a set of norms and taboos that govern our interactions. This, for an everyday example, can be as simple as walking aboard an elevator and figuring out where you need to stand. It can be as simple as walking into a school dance, an office party, or any other social setting and figuring out the rules and the expectations. Where are people sitting? What are people wearing? How much food are people eating yet? And
yeah,
if they are, how much are they eating? You know, all these little things, these little calculations that most of us take for granted.
Yeah, yeah. And this totally gets into, like, the institutional idea and even, like, ties back into ideology, right? Ideology is one of the demons, but in a way it's also one of the angels, right?
Yeah.
Because it supplies the moral sense and the cultural taboos for us to keep from being violent.
This one touches on some of the discussions we had in our Leaping into the Void episode, where we talked about, you know, the urge to jump off a building, the
yeah,
irrational urge, when you're, you know, in a high place. But it also, like, I find myself in a gallery, for instance, and there'll be this famous work of art, and I could literally reach out, grab it, and start licking it.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think about it. I'm not actually tempted to do it, but I keep thinking, like, what's the worst thing I could possibly do in this gallery? To lick the painting, and there's something terrifying about considering it. Or not even considering it, just running that simulation in my mind.
Yeah, but what's keeping you from doing it is probably a combination of your brain and the social institutions around you, especially in the museum.
Yeah, it's the two angels of self-control and moral sense are standing by me, holding me back. and maybe the fourth angel as well, and that's reason. This is the power to reflect, deduce, and, quote, guide the application of the other better angels of our nature. So reason's kind of the quarterback of, if I'm using my sports analogy
correctly.
I have
no idea. I'm the wrong person to ask, but yeah, mm-hmm, I'll go with it.
Yeah, the quarterback then for the other angels and saying, all right, you run there, you hold him back so he doesn't lick the painting, and empathy will be standing over there so he doesn't judge the guard too harshly.
Right.
All right, and then on top of these angels, they don't have to go in and defeat these demons alone. They also have, you could say, institutional help from the five historical forces. And these, Pinker argues, are the exogenous forces that favor peaceful motives and are the forces that are largely responsible for bringing about a decline in violence. So the first force here, the first of the five historical forces that Pinker presents is the Leviathan nation state. So Leviathan here is a reference to Thomas Hobbes in his 1651 book, Leviathan, a book on statecraft and the structure of society and legitimate government.
Yeah, he's not actually talking about a sea monster.
Right.
He means government.
And in this case, in Pinker's argument, this is state and judiciary that has a monopoly on the use of force. And yes, this gives it great power to abuse, but also to reduce tendencies for exploitive attacks and revenge. It can also dismantle self-serving biases that make everyone believe they're individually in the right.
Yeah, right, especially when you've got that moralization gap at hand.
Yes. Now, the next force is commerce, which this one makes me think of, you know, Wu-Tang's cream.
Cash rules everything around
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Dollar bills, yo.
Yeah. Because Pinker here is arguing that that this is the positive sum game in which everybody can win. Trade and communication means that people are more valuable alive than dead, and so there's less need to demonize and less need to destroy other groups and salt the earth, because at the very least, your cruelty will take a commercial form. as opposed to a barbarically violent one.
This is where we get those sort of like libertarian arguments that like capitalism and commercialism is ultimately like the guiding force that's going to keep us civilized, right? Because it's essentially tied into that risk reward system that's keeping our brain from devolving into just utter barbarism.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's some merit there. Now, you can certainly say that it can't act in isolation. It has to have these other elements, such as the next force, which is feminization. So this is the ongoing process by which cultures increasingly respect women. And Pinker argues that since males tend to be the violent ones or the more violent ones, that with the empowerment of women, feminized cultures move away from the glorification of war and they produce fewer, quote, rootless young men.
Right. Yeah. So as we're recording this, the movie Wonder Woman just came out and has been a huge hit. And you can look at that as like a cultural touchstone, right, of our society, at least, progressing in the form of feminization. Now, there's obviously some pushback against that, too, but Pinker's argument here is that it's a good thing.
All right, and the next one is cosmopolitanism, and this is just about literacy, mobility, mass media, all of it coming together to promote people toward an understanding of other people and, quote, expand their circle of sympathy.
Right, yeah. Whenever I think of the term cosmopolitanism, I think of the idea of not adhering necessarily to the idea that you're a citizen of a particular nation, but that you're a citizen of the world and that you're in it together with all of humanity.
And finally, the escalator of reason. And this idea is that the application of knowledge and rationality can force people to recognize cycles of violence in the world and see it all as something that needs to be solved rather than won. And they may even come to the point of realizing that their own interests and privileges shouldn't always trump the interests of others.
Whew, okay. So, man, we've barely covered like half this book, but we just flew through a bunch of it. So we've got the demons, we've got the angels, we've got the historical forces. This is basically like the primary layout for Pinker's big argument here. But not everybody agrees with this guy, right?
Yeah, I mean, this book was, when it came out several years back, was a big deal and continues to resonate. And we're discussing it because it has a lot of truth in it, and it does resonate. And it does give us perspective on how we're behaving and functioning as a culture and what direction we might be moving in. And Pinker isn't the only one to make this claim or to have made it. Joshua L. Goldstein presented a similar view in Winning the War on War, the Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. That was also in 2011. And both authors credit John E. Mueller's 1989 book, Retreat from Doomsday, The Obsolescence of Major War. And you can trace similar concepts, the idea that we're becoming more peaceful, we're getting further away from war, at least back as far as the 19th century French Enlightenment.
Mm.
Now, American analyst John Arquella argues that another major factor that could be playing a role in the reduction of global battlefield casualties is the stalemate imposed by the greater horrors of nuclear war. Now, Pinker certainly takes nukes into account, but he says that, hey, past WMDs like poison gas, these didn't prevent more wars, and so nukes alone are not going to do it either.
Right.
But, of course, nuclear weapons are far more destructive on a level that has changed the balance of power.
Totally goes back to that one-sentence example that he had earlier about the flamethrower in the Enola Gay.
Now, one of the critics that I ran across was English political philosopher and author John N. Gray. And I just want to read a couple of arguments that he made regarding Pinker. He says, quote, no serious military historian doubts that fear of their use, and he means nuclear weapons, has been a major factor in preventing conflict between great powers. Moreover, deaths of noncombatants have been steadily rising. Around 1 million of the 10 million deaths due to the First World War were of noncombatants, whereas around half of the more than 50 million casualties of the Second World War and over 90% of the millions who have perished in the violence that has racked the Congo for decades belong in that category.
Hmm.
Says we haven't had big wars chew up so many lives, but we've engaged in proxy wars. He says, quote, while it's true that war has changed, it has not become less destructive. Rather than a contest between well-organized states that can at some point negotiate peace, it is now more often a many-sided conflict in fractured or collapsed states that no one has the power to end.
Wow. All right. That's not comforting.
He also argues that depending upon casualty numbers doesn't take into account the equal weight of lives lost, say, under the boot heel of oppressive regimes and social structures. And he points out that the United States, for instance, may be, depending on who's commenting, considered the most advanced society in the world, but it also has the highest rate of incarceration. A quarter of all the world's prisoners are tied up in that. And a disproportionately number of them are African Americans. And then on top of this, many of the prisoners in question are mentally ill, or they're aged, or they're just they're unhealthy at this point in their lives.
Right.
So you have to ask yourself, how does that play out in this perception of violence? Also worth noting, the U.S. has the largest military in the world by a considerable margin.
All right. So things that we like really excel at: prisons, mental illness, and militaries.
Yeah, I mean, basically, that's kind of Gray's argument here is yeah, to what extent can war casualties alone be the metric for your discussion here?
So Gray is like the cynical side of me again taking over and saying, not so fast, Pinker. The world's a lot worse off than you think.
Now, these quotes are from Gray's book, The Soul of the Marionette, A Short Inquiry into Human Freedom. And there's an excerpt from it that you'll find on The Guardian. .com. I'll include a link to that on the landing page for this episode. It goes on for a bit, but he ends up talking about the Black Mirror of Dr. John Dee.
Oh, so, wow!
Yeah,
okay,
so it's worth checking out.
Well, if you're deep into Stuff to Blow Your Mind territory, that'll be an interesting connection.
Now, another note about war and violence. This is from Ian Magazine's "Is There a War Instinct?" by evolutionary biologist David P. Barash. And he points out that, quote, violence is almost certainly deeply entrenched in human nature, warfare not so much. So he has this analogy that he draws on, where he's saying that violence is like a marriage, and that war, on the other hand, is like arranging a wedding with the bridal shower and the bachelor party and all of this.
Yeah.
He says that it's, quote, it's safe to assume that neither employing a photographer, serving a multi-tiered wedding cake, enlisting bridesmaids, nor tying baby shoes to the bumper of a newlywed's car spring from the human genome, although people are capable of doing all of these things. By the same token, plain old interpersonal violence is a real, albeit regrettable, part of human nature. War is even more regrettable, but it is no more natural than a bridal shower or the assembly line used to construct a stealth bomber. And he argues that Pinker exaggerates our pre-existing natural tendency for war. He argues that recent anthropological studies from Douglas Fry and others prove that the predominant mode of human life, again, that sort of that, you know, broad analysis of what it is to be a human being, that for most of that we're nomadic hunters and gatherers.
Yeah.
That war is a group-based lethal use of lethal violence against other groups was almost non-existent for most of this time. It only emerged within the early agricultural surplus period and emerged with the rise of elaborate tribal organizations, and this is what allowed the warrior ethos and military leadership of sorts to emerge. So he's saying war has not always been with us. It's a recent phenomenon when you consider the full history of our species.
So again, that seems like a positive thing. Now, we just hit you with a lot, listeners.
Yeah.
That was like a sledgehammer of information about war, human nature, and violence.
Mm-hmm.
But we, you know, I think based on like this experience that I'm feeling, I think other people are feeling it too. Just like every day, it's like, oh gosh, like all these horrible things are happening. Is this what we're just destined to keep doing to each other forever? Pinker's argument is at least, no, like we're proceeding, we're finding ways and we're understanding how our brains work so that this will eventually slow down. It already is slowing down and probably won't ever stop, but it will be minimized.
Yeah, I think the two critics that I mentioned here, I think they make valid points, and I think it's important to consider the criticism.
Yeah.
But on the same hand, I really like Pinker's argument. And not just because I feel like I have to live and act as an optimist, and I can't really live and act as a pessimist, but
yeah.
but I do think he makes a convincing argument for the most part.
So, listeners, are you convinced? Do you think Pinker's got it right? Do you feel better? I feel a little bit better. Pinker,
yeah.
That person who let me borrow this book and said you should read this, the objective achieved. Like, it did make me feel a little bit better. So do we agree with this? Do we not agree with it? Maybe we agree with Barash and Gray instead. Let us know. We are on social media where you can talk to us about all of your violent urges on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram. And as Robert mentioned, the landing page for this will be on stufftoblowyourmind.com, where we have all of our blog posts, all of our videos, and every episode of the podcast.
And you can always reach out to us the old-fashioned way. Shoot us an email at blowthemind@houseofworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.